This hour of the Jason Rancho is brought to you by our friends over at Robinson Company Structural Moving and Foundation Repair. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. Producer Darren, push the button.
What's trending in Trumplandia?
So yesterday, Michael Cohen, the former personal attorney for Donald Trump as candidate and as businessman, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison for his role in paying women to keep quiet about their alleged affairs with Donald Trump. And it means the president is potentially in trouble. In fact, he likely is if what is in some of these court documents is true. The question is, how true is it? The question is, what other context comes into play? Because it seems he was the one who ordered Michael Cohen to make the payments. That is at least what the prosecutors believe, and that is a felony in how it all went down. Here's Judge Andrew Napolitano on Fox News.
Career prosecutors here in New York City have evidence that the president of the United States committed a felony by ordering and paying Michael Cohen to break the law. How do we know that? They told that to the federal judge. Under the rules, they can't tell that to a federal judge unless they actually have that hardcore evidence. Under the rules, they can't tell that to a federal judge unless they intend to do something with that evidence. The U.S. attorney in Manhattan, a Donald Trump appointee, taking a page from Jeff Sessions' book, recused himself, leaving this case in the hands of the full-time career professional prosecutors. They are the ones who prosecuted Michael Cohen. They are the ones who told the federal judge that Donald Trump orchestrated these unlawful payments. They are the ones who made the agreement with AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, which ties a bow on all of this.
But how exactly does that mean the president broke the law? The president make the payments and everyone acknowledges that. So where is the felony?
The felony is paying Michael Cohen to commit a felony. It's pretty basic. Somebody hires you. A hires B to shoot someone. A is as liable as if he had pulled the trigger. You pay someone to commit a crime, they commit the crime, you are liable, criminally liable, for their commission of that crime as well as their being liable. That's what the prosecutors told the federal judge.
They've not announced whether there was criminal intent on the president's part, which would be required for prosecution.
Yes. We don't know what they know.
Now that's important. That's the most important in all of this. Was there criminal intent? Now, just moments ago, less than an hour ago, the president sent out a series of tweets. And the timing is actually kind of weird because it's a full statement via Twitter. It's three separate tweets, but they didn't come right after each other. There was like 10 minutes in between each of them being sent, which is throwing me a little bit. But he said, I never directed Michael Cohen to break the law. He was a lawyer and he is supposed to know the law. It's called advice of counsel, and a lawyer has great liability if a mistake is made. That's why they get paid. Despite that many campaign finance lawyers have strongly stated that I did nothing wrong with respect to campaign finance laws, if they even apply, because this was not campaign finance. Cohen was guilty on many charges unrelated to me, but he pled to two campaign charges which were not criminal and of which he was probably not guilty even on a civil basis. Those charges were just agreed to by him in order to embarrass the president and get a much reduced prison sentence, which he did, including the fact that his family was temporarily let off the hook. As a lawyer, Michael Cohen has great liability to me. So those were the reactions of the president just moments ago. And what I think is interesting here is if Michael Cohen came to him and said, hey, I can make this payment, it's totally kosher. Well, the presumption from the client is, okay, go for it. You say it's kosher, right? There's no criminal intent there. Now, if you can prove that President Trump, or at the time, candidate Trump, knew that this was illegal, then he's in trouble. And I don't know how you prove criminal intent in a situation. Is he going to have an email that says, hey, go ahead and go break the law for me, Michael Cohen? Like, I don't know exactly how you're supposed to handle that. Now, I know that there are a lot of people like Denny Heck, a congressman out in Tacoma, who thinks all of this is going to lead to the impeachment and probably imprisonment of Donald Trump. It's not. It's not. Let's just be clear about that. Because if all of this is absolutely true, I find it hard to believe that people who are kind of in the middle, political independents, maybe they lean to the right, maybe they lean to the left, maybe they don't lean anywhere at all. It's literally a 50-50 split on how they view things, who are not virulently anti-Trump the way that rabid progressives are, I can't believe they look at this and say, yeah, we should throw him in jail. I just don't believe that people will look at this way. Dan Abrams on ABC, he's the chief legal analyst. He said Michael Cohen actually got off easy in all of this.
It seems that here, when the probation department had recommended 42 months, which was a downward departure from the 51 to 63, the fact that he's now getting 36 months, I think is a win. Keep in mind, in the federal system, that means that he would have to serve at least 85% of that time, even with good behavior.
So we're going to get a deeper dive into all of this from a legal perspective when lawyer Ann Bremner stops by live at 7 o'clock, so I can't wait for that. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The sports ball.
So according to reports, the owner of the Phoenix Sun is so... The Phoenix Suns, I almost said it was like the newspaper, but it's not. It's the basketball team. He's so annoyed and fed up with the city council there that he apparently threatened to leave the city and come to either Las Vegas or Seattle. Let me tell you something real quick, sir. Because my assumption is Robert Sarver, who's the owner of the Suns, is listening. He probably... I think he's a subscriber to the podcast. Because our show is awesome. If you're upset with the council in Phoenix, probably go to Las Vegas and not Seattle. Something tells me that if you're legitimately looking at whether or not a council's going to be supportive of business in general, maybe not come to the Seattle area. I'm just throwing that out there. Now, they want to renovate their arena in Phoenix. It's not seen any sort of meaningful renovation since 1992. And according to the Arizona Republic, this threat came up after the council was trying to figure out whether or not they were going to pay $150 million in public funds to this project. And apparently the people there are like, we don't want to spend this kind of money. So the council didn't end up voting on it because they didn't have the votes. And so that left the Suns in a position of, okay, well, if you're not going to give us some money, we could go somewhere else. Now, Sarver told ABC 15.
I'm looking at different options here within the Valley. First priority is downtown Phoenix, but if that's not something the city wants to do, then, you know, I got to look somewhere else.
And I understand that perspective because, look, especially when it comes to baseball, but also when it comes to football and basketball and soccer, we're clearly seeing upgrades to the infrastructure. Right, we're clearly seeing upgrades to stadiums, to arenas. That's because, in large part, it's being driven by consumers. We want to go into a newer building. We don't want to go into a rundown arena. And especially when we consider how much money we're spending for a ticket, we kind of want to see that upgrade. But now we're being told, actually, no, there was no threat. But that's according to the Sun CEO, Jason Rowley. So he did an interview yesterday with KPNX TV. And he says there was no threat. But even when he's saying there's no threat, he brings up Seattle and Las Vegas, which makes it sound like it is, in fact, a threat.
The reality is that we have made zero threats about going to any other city. Forget the ones that you've mentioned.
Where did that come from?
I have no idea where that came from.
This is where it came from. This statement right here.
Is it a well-known fact that the city of Seattle is putting $700 million into Key Arena? It's a well-known fact. Is it a well-known fact that the city of Las Vegas is actively trying to attract a Major League Baseball team? They're actively trying to attract an NBA team, no question about it. But that is not coming from us. We are not making those threats. We are focused on this town, this city, downtown Phoenix, and getting our deal done. If you think about it logically, why would we be making those threats when we're in the midst of trying to get a deal done for the last 3 years? It doesn't logically make any sense.
It totally logically makes sense because it's your leverage. It totally makes sense. Now, it makes sense that he's pushing back publicly because he didn't want these threats to go public, because then it tells your fan base to be a little less loyal because it shows that you're not loyal to the city and to the fans. I mean, it makes total sense to do it behind the scenes. That's your leverage with the council. Hey, yeah, look, if you don't want to give us this $150 million, given how much we actually bring to this market, we're just going to go somewhere else. In fact, Seattle is dying for a team. Las Vegas clearly is showing they want to expand. They are expanding with football. They're going to want to expand with basketball. They've been talking about that. We'll leave. But I don't want them. Aren't they known as like the worst run team in the NBA? That's what I saw.
Better than no team.
Is it though?
Yeah.
Don't you want to hold out for a good team? By the way, where are they going to put them?
Hold out for a good team? Why would a good team move?
Because they can get a brand new...
The Warriors aren't going to just
decide
they are. That we're
well, you
coming
just
to Seattle.
Make that assumption. What do you know about
basketball?
What do you know about basketball?
Not a lot, to be honest.
Right? I don't... I mean, I don't want to... I know some people are super excited about the prospects of a team. The team's not coming here anytime soon. It's not. And if you think the Key Arena renovation is suddenly going to get people excited, I really don't. What I suspect is there are going to be a lot of scenarios like this where there's a threat for move, but it's not going to come to fruition. They're just using it for leverage, which, again, is kind of a smart position for any of these teams to take. You're listening to the Jason Rancher. Do you want the Suns here? Are they good? They're not good, right?
They're not very good, but they have Devin Booker. He's good.
Who else do they have?
I don't know.
Exactly.
They used to have Steve Nash.
Yeah, used to doesn't get butts in seats, man.
Charles Barkley played there, I think.
That's your contribution?
Yeah.
Charles Barkley, as a result of the move, may one time tweet that his former team is moving to Seattle, and that's good enough for producer Darren. You're listening to the Jason Rancho, 1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation on the Numb Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. It's the Jason Rancho. Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show. UK Prime Minister Theresa May survived a vote of no confidence last night, but the battle in Brussels to get a deal on Brexit remains incredibly tough. Joining us live this morning from London is Simon Owen of Fox News Radio. Simon, good morning. Take us through, if you could, yesterday's vote and the news that she's likely not going to stay in that position for too much longer.
Yes, and Theresa May wrapped up last night by calling it a long and challenging day. And I think she could be forgiven for saying that about most days at the moment. We got word early yesterday morning that some lawmakers in her own party were mounting a challenge to topple her, asking for a vote of no confidence. And the party said that would take place later yesterday. And so it's a vote among lawmakers in her own party. The votes were counted, and the result was announced later yesterday, and it was confirmation that Theresa May officially has the backing of her party, which means she stays as British Prime Minister. Now, the result, May won by 200 votes to 117, so it's roughly a two-thirds majority. But that also means that a third of her lawmakers said that they wanted her out, and that's being seen as a significant show of dissent. So she's safe to an extent. For one thing, she can't be challenged for the leadership for another year now because she's faced this challenge and seen it off. But she's also been sent a clear warning that it's not plain sailing, and her problems are now back to being relating to the Brexit divorce from the EU, because just because she's won this vote of confidence, she still has an uphill battle on her hands to try and get her proposal for Britain's Brexit divorce through Parliament. And so today, to fast forward to Friday, do you know what? I forget what day it is. Fast forward to today, to Thursday, Theresa May is now in Brussels at an EU summit where she's seeking what she calls assurances from fellow EU presidents and prime ministers. And she's asking them to smooth out a couple of things in the divorce she negotiated in the hope that that will be enough to sell it to lawmakers here in London.
So when we talk about the Brexit deal and wherever it ends up going, I think sometimes we don't talk about how this impacts someone who's listening to us this morning in Bellevue or Tacoma, Marysville. How is what's going on there impacting us here in the United States?
Well, I mean, ultimately, probably not very much. But there is the potential in a couple of senses of how this has an impact. In the first sense, Britain is no longer, presuming it does leave, and the date is set for March 29th, but presuming that Brexit goes ahead, then Britain is released from various constrictions and ties it has to the European Union. And the most obvious one there is on trade. It means that the UK and, for instance, the United States are now able to strike a bilateral free trade agreement if that's what they want to do. Currently, Britain can't do that because everything has to be negotiated. The EU negotiates as one. So there's one aspect there that changes. On the other hand, you know, what Theresa May is trying to do is get parliamentary approval for an agreement on Britain's future relationship with the European Union. And she's having real trouble doing it. Now, if she fails to get that, then Britain runs the risk of having what people call either a cliff-edge Brexit, if they don't like it, or a clean Brexit, if they do like the idea. It's just the choice of words as you see fit. Yeah. And that means that overnight on March 29th, all sorts of rules would simply change in one go, whether that's on trade, security, immigration, border rules, whatever else. It would be a significant rupture. And if that goes badly, and Theresa May says it would be bad, it would cause significant economic damage, then, you know, the UK as a large economy, the fifth largest economy in the world, that's something that could start having an impact on an economic level around the world if Brexit doesn't go smoothly. But ultimately, the day-to-day manoeuvrings in 10 Downing Street and the politics of the UK probably doesn't have a huge amount of impact in terms of people's day-to-day life on the West Coast.
Well, then here's the last question, and arguably it's the most important one. I'm going to London next Friday for about 2 weeks. Am I going to be impacted in any way when I get there?
Unlikely. You'll be able to get in, put it that way, unless the country has fallen. And sometimes at the moment, it seems like British politics is teetering on the brink of such a total meltdown that you never know.
Yeah.
But the chances are, if anything, if you've been here in recent years, the value of the pound has not been doing particularly well against the dollar because of all the Brexit uncertainty. So the chances are, I suspect, the main impact is you might find your dollars go a little bit further than on previous trips.
I don't like that for you because you're based in London, but I like that for me as I visit. So once I get there and leave, then we can figure out the currency situation a little bit more in favor of you. I've been talking again with Simon Owen from Fox News Radio live in London. Simon, thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to The Jason Brand Show, 1-800-465-877. Welcome back to The Jason Brand Show. Membership is not looking good for the Seattle Public School Unions. Once the Supreme Court ruled that teachers can't be forced to join unions under this threat of being fired, the union saw a significant loss of membership. And of course, with it, the dues they pay. Joining us this morning with the news is Lee Finna, the director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center. Lee, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Jason.
Absolutely. So union dues are about $1,000 a year. So how many opted to keep their money instead of giving it to the Seattle Public School Union?
In the last few months, 600... Wow. Public school employees in the Seattle Education Association union have dropped out of the union. That's about 10% of the total.
And this is all happening because they now have this ability to without fear of losing their jobs, correct?
That's exactly right. Because in late June, the U.S. Supreme Court held in this Janus case that public employees no longer can be forced to be a member of a union as a condition of employment as in order to keep their job. This was put in place by law in 1967. So we're talking six decades of forced forced membership in a union as a condition of teaching in the schools. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that that's a violation of the teachers' First Amendment right of free association. And as a result, teachers and other members of the Seattle Education Association have decided to keep their dues, which are substantial. This is about $1,000 a year for themselves, give themselves a raise, and not be a member of this coercive union.
It's interesting because that number generally indicates to me that you had a lot of people whose hearts weren't really in what the union was doing to some degree, that they're willing to pull out the second that they're given that opportunity. But at the same time, last year, it seemed like the narrative was the teachers' union in Seattle was pretty strong. They were able to negotiate a whole bunch of their asks successfully. So where's the disconnect where you've got membership that isn't as strong as we think, but the unions seem to be acting and being treated as if they're just as strong as they were before?
Well, I think the disconnect is that teachers see themselves as professionals who should be treated and respected as professionals and not as as a employee that kowtows to some powerful entity that decides that they're going to close the schools due to a labor strike. And I think that whole coercive feature of labor strikes, closing schools when schools should be open mm-hmm. to teach students, that a lot of teachers don't like that. It's against their whole calling as a teacher. They want to be in schools that are open. They want to be treated with respect. They want to be paid based on their knowledge and their commitment to education, not based on seniority standing in a union. They don't want to be assigned to schools based on seniority standing. There's a lot of components of the powerful union that professional teachers do not like. And that's why I think a lot of dropping out. And this mm-hmm. is costing the union significant money every month. Now, this is a loss of $43,000 a month, which adds up to about over $500,000 in dues that the union is not collecting. And I think it's significant that now what the union is doing is raising the dues on the remaining members.
which is
another coercive fashion. So,
which I have to assume.
Yes, you're right.
You're right about
the power, you know, of the union to demand higher pay and benefits. But I don't think that's all that teachers care about.
Yeah, and my assumption, Liev, is that move to increase the dues of the other members is going to make it a little bit easier for them to say, okay, I'm not going to give you more than $1,000 at this point every single year. I'm going to leave as well. I just feel like it's going to hasten the demise potentially, or at least a lot of the significant power coming from the unions.
I think so too. I was shocked to see that on September 1st, the Seattle Education Association increased dues on the remaining members that did not leave. And what is that? What kind of a message of respect is that? I mean, you know, and I haven't analyzed all the data yet, but I suspect that the members of the union that are at least able to pay are the ones getting hardest hit with these increases. I can't prove that yet, but I'm seeing that from national data is what we're hearing. That here the union is supposed to be helping out the people with the least economic power in our society, yet it appears from national data that the unions are putting the burden of these pay increases on just those people, the least able to pay.
So how should the union react to this kind of news?
The union, this is actually an opportunity to reform itself from within. A union that wants to keep its members should start listening to what its members want. And that is a good phenomenon, right? And in the private sector, companies are always trying to figure out what its customers want. Well, unions have enjoyed so much power that they have not been listening to union members. And so this is actually going to provide for some opportunities from reform from within, and perhaps union leadership will start asking what the rank and file want.
Yeah, the question is, how many more union members do they need to lose before they realize that that's probably the right move for them in paying a little bit closer attention to the needs of their members? So we'll end up finding out. Again, about 600 over the course of the last few months have left the Seattle Public Teachers Union. For more information on this, you can check out washingtonpolicy.org. I've been talking with Liev Finnis. She's the director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center. Liev, thank you so much for joining us live this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Absolutely. Again, check out washingtonpolicy.org, a wonderful conservative organization here in Washington State that is shining a spotlight on some news that some in the media would prefer that we not shine a spotlight on. Washingtonpolicy.org. You're listening to the Jason Rancho. Welcome back to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. If you listen to the show, it should come as no surprise that free speech concerns are exceptionally valid when it comes to college campuses here in Washington and everywhere else across the country. Gonzaga bans Ben Shapiro. A professor is held hostage for not supporting a student protest over at Evergreen. Both the First Amendment and the spirit of the First Amendment are under assault on college campuses. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the FIRE, just released a study that actually says it's not nearly as bad as some of us think, but there's clearly some room for improvement. Joining me on the line from the FIRE is Laura Belts. Laura, good morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you guys just put out this study. It's a spotlight on speech codes. Speech codes generally mean any kind of regulation that a campus enforces that you believe goes a little bit too far. You outline them as green light, orange, or red light being the worst. What did you generally find?
Well, yes, we rate them on a kind of traffic light scale based on First Amendment legal standards. So if policies aren't infringing on free speech, they get a green light. They get a yellow light if they're more vague or narrow restrictions. And then the clear and substantial restrictions on protected speech, they get a red light. And we found that the types of clearly unconstitutional policies are going down across the country through various efforts to get these policies changed, but there are still a lot of those vague yellow light policies on the books, and then there's quite a few, in fact, in the state of Washington.
Well, let's go through some of them in the state of Washington. For the most part, we'll focus on public schools, but it should be noted, private schools, while they generally can get away, unless they're in California, they generally can get away with policies that would be otherwise deemed unconstitutional, with the exception of when they put in their policies that they will protect certain types of speech, and then they go against it because they violated a contract. But here in Washington State, who are some of the offenders?
Well, Evergreen State, which you mentioned, of course, they get our worst red light rating. A couple policies from there, they tell students that they must be civil in all their interactions. And of course, that's a fine thing to suggest to students, but when you actually give that policy power behind it and say that they must be civil, that means that just about any kind of speech that the university disagrees with or thinks is too controversial could be sanctioned under that policy.
It's funny at Evergreen, by the way.
Another one at Evergreen says they can only use two areas on the whole campus to hold a protest.
Well, and so that's the interesting thing, because it's funny for a college like Evergreen, where professors encourage students to speak out and protest. But protest, by its very nature, can be uncivil.
Right, exactly. And everyone's definition of what civility is varies, of course. And you're exactly right that often these conversations can get heated. When you're in the midst of an intellectual debate, there are going to be hurt feelings and people might get passionate about it. But that doesn't mean that speech can be sanctioned. And it certainly can't at a public university bound by the First Amendment.
Now, I expect everyone expects Evergreen high on this list. What else did you find in Washington?
Another school that gets a red light rating in Washington is Eastern Washington University. They have an IT policy that says it's a violation of university policy for anyone to send annoying or offensive messages over their IT network. So again, these broad subjective terms like annoying or offensive, they can be applied to restrict just about any type of speech that is protected under the First Amendment. So that earns our red light rating.
Just joining me, I'm talking with Laura Belts from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, thefire.org. It's a wonderful organization that actually helped me when I was in college, and so I've been following them with great interest over the years. We're talking about the sort of the landscape as it relates to First Amendment rights on college campuses. We've been focusing a lot on Washington, but when you look nationally, there are some trends I've noticed, the same trends you guys have noticed, especially when it comes to quote unquote harassment or sexual harassment, when, you know, legally speaking, it's got a very specific definition. But when you look at some of the ways it's being interpreted by colleges, you find overly broad commentary on what is deemed sexual harassment.
Right. At Whitman College, which is a private college, but as you've noted, private schools that promise their students free speech are on the hook for that, and Whitman does. They define harassment as unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature, and they say that examples of sexual harassment include jokes, gestures, pictures, stereotyping, and these things could all be a part of a pattern of conduct that does constitute harassment. But when you list them out like that, saying that jokes are prohibited, students are bound to read a policy like that and think that they're prohibited across the board, and they may be worried about voicing their opinion, particularly if it's a controversial one, and they may self-censor themselves because of policies like this.
In your experience, what do you think the motivation is behind some of these policies? Is it to make everyone happy and try to get to a point on campus where no one is quote-unquote offended? Is it because they fear lawsuits? Is it because they have a nefarious take on all of this? Like, where do you think it's coming from?
I think it could be a little from column A, a little column B, yeah, kind of thing here, that it varies. A lot of times, honestly, colleges don't even know what policies are on the books. You have a situation where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, where one department at a school will put out one harassment policy, and then the legal office has their official one, the residence hall policy has another definition of harassment. And so especially, I think, at the larger schools, you get this issue of having a bunch of policies defining the same term in different ways. It's really confusing for students, but that may be inadvertent. So that's a big reason why we maintain this spotlight database of school policies, in order to make sure that everyone's aware of what policies are on the books and what ones need to get fixed.
Well, it goes even beyond them not realizing it. They sometimes use language that is just legally untenable. This whole idea of pushing back against so-called hate speech doesn't actually mean it. Hate speech is not like this legally enforceable term, certainly not in the ways that you're seeing. Clark University, you point out in this report, that their handbook says that bias incidents involve, quote, treating someone negatively based upon characteristics, including, by the way, telling jokes based on a stereotype or name calling. That's 100% protected speech, 100% of the time.
Right.
And yet you can't do that at Clark University.
Yes, we see those bias incident policies popping up everywhere across the country. And it seems to be a way that the universities are trying to respond to students' concerns about hate speech, whatever that might mean to them, since it's such a subjective, undefined term. But they direct their students to kind of report on each other and to surveil each other and to report on any instance of hateful or biased speech. Even though that kind of speech, as you say, is protected by the First Amendment when standing alone. And so we've encouraged schools to instead use these policies to say, we'll offer support to students when they report these kinds of incidents, but we won't investigate or punish the alleged perpetrators, to turn it into a support system rather than a reporting and punishing system.
So the trend that we've seen over the course of the last few years, we are seeing it here in Washington. Gonzaga recently said, hey, you know what, we think that Ben Shapiro coming on campus is going to bring out protesters who are going to say mean things, and it's going to be expensive to handle security, so we're just going to say no to the event. And again, it's a college that's private, so they get to do that. But at the University of Washington here in Seattle, they said virtually the same thing for a previous speech against that the UW College Republicans wanted to have. And they sued, and they actually ended up winning. I mean, they ended up saying, the court saying, yeah, you can't just put these security fees that are incredibly onerous or just cancel them outright on a public campus.
Exactly. When a student group has invited a speaker to come in, the university must do everything in its power in order to get to allow that speaker to speak to the students. And we are finding that they're suddenly putting these vague security fees on speakers, saying, you know, your event is too controversial. We've heard a lot of fuss at other campuses where you visited, mm-hmm. so you're not allowed to come here. And that's simply impermissible under the First Amendment. And so what we encourage students to do in a situation like that, if a speaker is coming to their campus that they disagree with, we tell them that they should go out and throw their counter protest and maybe hand out flyers, write an op-ed, hold another event, counter programming. And that's how to respond to a speaker you dislike, rather than asking them to be disinvited or censored.
If you want to check this report out, it's at thefire.org. If you've got a kid who goes to college, maybe you're a college student yourself, if you've got a kid who's about to go to college, all of you in your family, including your kids, should make sure you bookmark thefire.org to find out exactly what's happening on campus and get help if you ever in a position where you need it. Again, go to thefire.org. My last question for you, what is, in your opinion, this is just you, what's the worst policy you've seen?
I think I dislike the policies the most that tell students that they have to have this long waiting period before protesting on campus. Some schools say it's 10 days, other schools say 2 weeks. It's just entirely unreasonable that any kind of expressive activity that a student wants to have on a public college campus has to have that sort of lead time. Because those are real policies, that 2 week one and the 10 day one. And so those really offend me the most, personally.
It's because you're an impatient person, clearly. For more on this,
no.
I'm with you.
News cycle, you got to get out and respond to events.
I'm just as impatient. Go to thefire.org right now to check out this report. The major takeaway for me was things are getting better, but there is still a lot of room for improvement, including and especially, I suppose, here in Washington State. We've been talking with Laura Belt from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Laura, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show.